I have a much lengthier title, but Katie's was just fine. I'm going to talk about a novel concept for the detection of dark matter. It's going to involve antideuterons. We've briefly sketched out the idea for this in an astrophysical journal article that was published earlier in the year. The only good thing that's happened since then is this is transited from a virtual project to a real one, since we now have funding from NASA to pursue this idea. Several years ago, in fact, Donato proposed using antideuterons as a way to detect neutralinos, which of course are a candidate for dark matter. This was talked about a little bit this morning. Neutralinos are their own antiparticles, so they can annihilate in the halo, producing antimatter. Every now and then, an antiproton finds an antineutron in the hadronic shower, and together they form an antideuteron. You can see what the antideuteron signal looks like as a function of energy here for these primary antideuterons, that is, ones that are due to direct annihilation of the neutralino. At the same time, you have a secondary component of antideuterons, which is simply produced by high-energy cosmic rays interacting with hydrogen and helium in the interstellar medium. These, of course, can produce a baryon-antibaryon pair. Some of those pairs will be deuteron-antideuterons. And they have an energy dependence, which is indicated by this diagram right here. It's pretty obvious that if you can do an experiment at low enough energies, you have an exceptionally clean signature for the detection of dark matter via these primary antideuterons, because there's a large difference between the background and the signal. This, of course, is the same idea that people have suggested using, and in fact have used, to search for neutralinos through antiproton experiments on balloons. The difference there is that this curve tends to be shifted over substantially for kinematic reasons. It's a lot easier to produce a proton-antiproton pair than it is a deuteron-antideuteron pair. And therefore, those searches aren't particularly profitable because they're severely contaminated by the secondary component. So in principle, this is a very clean way to search for the neutralino. The downside on this is that, in fact, the fluxes that you're dealing with are exceptionally low, so you actually need some way to find such an obscenely low signal. And what that really requires, of course, then, is a detector which has a very large grasp, that is, an area solid angle product. Well, when Donato published this result, I thought it was very nice, but two things were lacking. One is a detector, and two, perhaps even more important than a detector, is a compelling theoretical motivation for wanting to go away from underground experiments, or better yet, augment underground experiments with a space-based experiment. And I'll try to give you some sort of motivation for that right here. On this left, what I'm showing is sort of the standard plot that you get from the underground dark matter experiment, showing the spin-independent cross-section for a neutralino versus a neutralino mass. And of course, these little crosses are all the various supersymmetric models which the theorists can generate. Each of these crosses isn't necessarily a model. It's hundreds of models, if not thousands of models. What I've shown here is I just grabbed these arbitrarily out of the literature, a canonical, say, first-generation experiment, which is CDMS, showing your sensitivity, of course, above this curve, so you're starting to probe this space. CDMS2 is down here. You're getting a little deeper into this space. And then Genius, which is sort of a canonical third-generation experiment, but I think sort of the numbers that you have here are very similar to those for the liquid xenon-type experiments that we heard about this morning. So it's just giving you an idea that you're getting down into this parameter space. But, of course, the bad news is there's a lot of it that you can't get to underground. On the other hand, if you look at this curve here, and I'll explain where this comes from, it actually is based on the detector concept that I'm going to describe to you. On a space-based experiment in a three-year mission, you can see that, in fact, this will be sensitive to everything above this line. What I think is very interesting is that, and we can all have our favorite prejudices, one prejudice is that the neutralino mass ought to be, say, somewhere between 40 or 50 GeV and 200 or 300 GeV, the lower bound being based on the accelerator experiments, the upper bound based on a random sampling I've done of theorists and their own prejudices. At any rate, you can see what's nice about this is that in this region of about about, say, 40 GeV up to 200 or 300 GeV. GAPS is essentially sensitive to every single supersymmetric model. Okay, so if, and there's a lot of ifs, if neutralinos exist and if they're in this prejudicial mass range, then, and if this concept works the way it's supposed to, then in fact we'll detect the neutralino. So this is sort of the theoretical motivation for why I think one ought to want to go to outer space to do this experiment. There's another way to see it as well. And this is a plot where I've simply taken the same SUSY models and collapsed them down in one dimension, namely the mass dimension, so that what you're seeing here is then the spin-independent cross-section on this axis, what you'd actually detect, the deuteron flux in a space-based experiment. And so the gap sensitivity lies above this horizontal line, and the sensitivity of the underground experiments lies to the right of this line. And I just took the GDIS curve and I sort of straightened it out here. That's why it looks straight, because I just wanted to make it look like an XY plot. And what you can see then is that there is a quadrant, namely the second quadrant right here, which is completely inaccessible to the underground experiments, but is accessible from a space-based experiment. And what I would simply argue to you is that it's the height of irrationality to have, I don't know, 6 or 10 or 12 experiments, you know, hunting over here, when you have a whole you know, quadrant of this graph, which is basically untouched and will always be untouched by the underground experiments. But you, as I hope to convince you, you can easily get at, well, not just by a space-based experiment, but actually by a by an experiment on a balloon. Okay, so I'll just briefly mention, since we heard about it this morning, the premier way to detect antiparticles right now is through the use of magnetic spectrometers. I'm not going to go through all this stuff. There is no problem with magnetic spectrometers other than that they're heavy and they don't have a big A omega, so they're not going to be very effective for searching for antideuterons. The concept I want to posit as might be a better way to do this is the following. We call it the gaseous antiparticle spectrometer. I've indicated sort of a cartoon of it down here. I have a gas cell filled with, the details are unimportant, anywhere from 10 to 20 atmospheres of, in this case, nitrogen gas. It's surrounded by a segmented X-ray spectrometer, and there's lots of alternatives for this. It can be segmented alkali halide crystal. It can be cadmium zinc telluride, which is what I really like it to be. But you have some sort of X-ray detector out here. A particle, in this case I've showed it as an antiproton, it works the same for an antideuteron, comes in through a time of flight system, which gives you an idea of the velocity and therefore the energy of the particle. It's slowed down in a degrader block and actually captured into an atom in the gas. So what you now have is you have an atom which has its normal complement of electrons, and it also has this heavy antiparticle, which of course is negative and therefore is also captured by this nucleus. Now, what happens next is this particle then undergoes a de-excitation. It just jumps from one quantum level to another quantum level. In doing so, of course, since its energy is so massive, it has an energy of the transition which is, you know, 3,400 times or, you know, 5,000 times higher than a normal electron jump. So what it does in the process, there's an OJ transition that takes place in the atom, and effectively all the electrons just explode away and take all the energy of the quantum jump with them, so that you have nothing left but a single antiparticle orbiting the nucleus. And then, of course, what will happen next is you'll just go bing, 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 and the particle will decay down through all the Bohr orbitals till it gets to the ground state, where it'll then annihilate with the nucleus, giving you a hadronic shower. So these are the characteristic X-rays, and in fact, the process I'm describing to you is not theoretical. This is something that's been extensively studied by atomic physicists all through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So although we've used these results to design an experiment, it's all based on you know, experimental data. So you're seeing here in particular ladder transitions, and these are in fact the X-rays that you see as this cascade takes place down through this atom. I won't go through the details of the atomic physics. They're actually relevant to all sorts of things in the design of the detector. I'll simply say that we're keying in particular on some of these transitions which occur in the hard X-rays, just because they're easy to detect with a thin detector, and I'll show you in a minute why we need a thin detector. And also, these X-rays easily escape the gas. If you use the lower energy X-rays, the gas is optically thick, you won't see them. If you use higher energy X-rays, it just gets very difficult to capture them in a thin detector. So most of what we're looking at are either 3 or 4 photons that we'll attempt to capture in the 20 to 150 kilovolt region. I'll just give you one idea of the type. I'm not going to go through the detector optimization because it's atomic physics. I will, however, indicate what several of the complications are. The first complication is that the antideuterons have to get to your detector, all right? And so you have to worry about whether the antideuterons annihilate versus whether you actually form an atom. And this is a problem that's actually very well understood from nuclear physics. It was studied to death for the deuterons in the 50s, and then later for the antideuterons. There's several channels you have to worry about. The first channel is simply direct annihilation. You're dealing with an antiparticle. It's plowing through the plastic and this degrader and into the gas. It bumps into an atom. It can just zap it, go away. You get a hadronic shower, no X-rays at all. Okay, that's the first thing that you have to worry about. The second thing is a more exotic process that probably most of us aren't familiar with. It's called Coulomb disintegration, which is well known, for instance, to take place in deuterons and antideuterons. Basically, this antiparticle is going through this mass of atoms. It's subject to the time-varying electric fields, Coulomb fields of all these atoms. You can treat that time-varying field as though it's a virtual photon field. And of course, the deuteron and the antideuteron are not very stable, so a photon, if they're sitting in a photon field, they'll just photodisassociate. That's called Coulomb disintegration. So this is actually not treated in the standard codes that talk about direct annihilation. You have to treat this separately. But the information is in the literature to do that. So what we do is, take the exact energy-dependent cross-sections, the known energy losses, the deuteron passes through the entire path of material as it goes in to be captured by an atom, and can calculate what the total losses are. There's some other processes which are less important that I won't talk about. The total effect of the annihilation is of order 10%. It's not small by accident. It's small because we must restrict the size of the detector to keep these annihilation channels not too big. Okay, so if you try to make the detector too big, then what's going to happen is either Coulomb disintegration or just normal annihilation is going to gobble up all the antideuterons before you see them. So it's no accident that the number's small. It's small because we've made it be small. Background is something that I could talk about for a long time, but happily I don't have enough time to talk about it. There are many, many sources of background that we have to worry about. The most important one I'll just mention is, in fact, that we're dealing with an enormous proton flux here. The antideuterons are down orders of magnitude, 5, 6 orders of magnitude, compared to the protons. So in fact, the primary signal that you have to worry about is you've got these protons plowing through your plastic. They're constantly triggering it. And at the same time, those of us who know about gamma ray astronomy, and that's where I come from, know that your detector is constantly bathed in a background of gamma rays, all right, continuum gamma rays. And if you're just unlucky enough to have 3 continuum or 4 continuum gamma rays at just the right energies, okay, going into your detector at exactly the same time it's triggered by antiproton, you're sunk, okay, or even a proton, you're sunk, okay. And in fact, since the proton flux drives everything because it's the highest, that's what you have to worry about. I mean, happily though, life is actually a little bit easier than it is for a gamma ray astronomer, in that we know what this background is. It's this evil background that's measured continually in these satellite experiments. And so just knowing what it is empirically, we can use that to figure out how many accidental events we'll actually see in this particular experiment. And in fact, the key thing that you want to worry about is that, in fact, it's nice. You have, I say 3 here. I think, in fact, our plans would be to use 4 X-rays. These 4 X-rays have infinitely well-defined energies determined by the Bohr energy levels of the atom. Okay, they occur basically simultaneously to within fractions of a nanosecond. And therefore, you have a fairly strict constraint that you can use to reject all these nasty sources of background. And in fact, we believe that we can obtain background rejection powers of order 10 to the 12. 12 to 10 to the 15, which is more than adequate for doing this experiment. I won't even begin to try to convince you that that's the case. That's why NASA's given me the money, so maybe I'll visit you in a year, and hopefully we'll have convinced you by then that it actually works. I just want to give you some idea of how one might do such a search if everything does work. In fact, the plan would be to do this in a satellite in a low Earth orbit mission. This is very nice, say, compared to AMS, because the detector is much more compact. We don't have to lug this thing up onto the space station. It can actually be flown on not a small experiment. This would be a NASA MIDEX, an Explorer-class mission. And I hasten to point out that the cost there of $200 million is simply the cost for a MIDEX mission. It's certainly not the cost of the detector. It has the main cost in here is associated with the launcher itself, not with the detector, which would be fairly modestly costed. So I've just shown this would launch on a Delta II rocket, and in fact it would fit in the shroud of a Delta. This is actually just a solar panel shown being deployed here. Of course, this is perhaps almost megalomaniacally getting ahead of the game of actually showing that the concept works. On the other hand, I think it's necessary to show that you can actually stuff this in something that you could actually do in a real experiment. So anyway, the I've compared this with AMS. I'm not sure what claims AMS. I don't think AMS makes any claims to detecting antideuterons, although in the Donato paper they talked about AMS detecting antideuterons, and that's their numbers. The GAPS experiment that we've designed here would be about 20 times more sensitive than AMS, assuming that AMS could detect antideuterons at all. And I've made no particular attempt to even begin to optimize the experiment at this point. Another way to proceed that I think is kind of just fun to talk about is doing this on an ultra-long duration balloon. In fact, NASA has been talking for some time now, they've been studying for a number of years, developing balloon payloads that would stay up anywhere from 100 days to, you know, maybe 500 days or so. So what I simply did was look at potential gaps on one of these ultra-long duration balloon experiments for a mission life. This is something very modest for these ultra-long duration balloon experiments, 200 days. This is a smaller detector. It's about half the size of the one that you would put on a satellite, because this basically represents the limit for the amount of mass that you could carry on an ultra-long duration balloon that you'd like to stay up for several hundred days. And so the peak grasp is correspondingly lower. What's really interesting about this, though, is it would actually cover about half of that second quadrant I showed you, which is completely inaccessible to the underground experiments. So even on a long duration balloon flight, you're able to get very deep into the SUSY parameter space, which you really have no other way to do. So I think for that reason, it's kind of interesting. The only other thing I want to say is, you know, our plans for the coming year or two is I've been talking to a number of people about getting a prototype detector onto an anti-proton beam, either at CERN or at the KEK facility in Japan. And so the next couple of years, what we're going to do is very carefully simulate the detector. In fact, we already have, but I think what I'm more interested in doing is more carefully simulating the background, developing a prototype detector, putting in it a beam, confirming what we see in the literature is the expected yield of X-rays in these types of gaseous detectors, and then from there, hopefully, ultimately, fly this thing on a balloon. Thank you. Yes?
How much balloon flight time do you need minimally to be successful?
That depends. The 200-day I picked got you into about half of that supersymmetric parameter space. If you want to back off from that, well, 50 days would get you about a fourth of the way into that SUSY parameter space. It's a discontinuous break, though, because, as you know, the longest balloon flights you can get right now are just a couple of weeks long, and in a couple of weeks, you just don't really do that well. I don't see any way to do this until you have access to the long duration balloons, which can carry a fairly heavy payload for a fairly long period of time. I mean, in some sense, you need to have the mass, and you also need to have the integration time.
Okay. Also say anti-helium X-rays?
Yes, and in fact, I originally proposed this to NASA almost 3 years ago as a means to detect antihelium. In fact, it's almost 100 times more sensitive than AMS for detecting antihelium. That's a provocative number, but I don't really care because I'm not interested in detecting antihelium. Yeah, exactly. So I'll maybe risk offending somebody. But yeah, it definitely works for that. Now, the catch there, to be fair, is you have to be careful because remember, this works at much lower energies than AMS, and there's difficulties. If you believe antihelium exists, getting the antihelium into our galaxy is much harder to do at low energies than it is at the energies AMS operates at, and if you actually took that into account, then that could whack the number down from being 100 times more sensitive than AMS to being 100 times less sensitive than AMS, because theorists very poorly understand how antihelium will actually propagate, you know, into our own galaxy because of the, you know, problem with the galactic wind.
Can you say something about the uncertainties in theoretical uncertainties, like in making?
That's a good point. I encourage theorists to work on this. I know several people are working on this. I don't think it's just the models I showed you here were based on no excessive clumping or anything like that. I mean, I think what Donato did was fairly conservative. So I think there is a lot of work that might potentially be done on the production aspect of things, because you are, you know, forming this sort of spray of antineutrons and antiprotons, and how those actually combine together. There's a lot of assumptions that go into that. So I think that's something where definitely a lot of more work can be done. Although, for instance, in the case, if you consider things like clumping, it'll enhance the signal, not suppress it. But I'm also worried a little bit about what I showed you, which is the background signal. In fact, I don't believe that the secondary antideuteron signal is quite as well understood as might be suggested by the curve that I showed you, which is also from the Donato paper. So in fact, I know now several people are actually trying to refine the calculations of the secondary antideuteron flux. Hopefully that won't go up too much, or else you'd be in the same situation that the people who are trying to use antiprotons to indirectly detect the neutralino. But I've got 5 or 6 orders of magnitude to give, so Katie, I hope the theorists aren't that bad.